first show I saw when I was 10. Yeah. I've seen them 67-ish times since then.
That is the voice of Strawberry Wanamaker, and she is a fan of the band Widespread Panic. I talked to her at a Panic show in Charleston, South Carolina. If you walk around a venue where Widespread Panic is playing and ask random people if this is the first time they've seen the band, it is difficult to meet someone who will answer yes. Most say no, then they tell you how many times they've seen the band perform. The numbers are astounding. On that night in Charleston, I interviewed 25 concert goers and met only one first-timer. When I came home, I did some math. The remaining 24 concert goers, collectively, had seen Widespread Panic play 1,509 times. That averages out to about 72 Panic shows per person. What is it about this band that turns casual fans into lifelong followers? The answer, I would learn, has a lot to do with the idea of family. But that did not become completely clear to me until I talked to a 16-year-old girl named Mary. Mary was there with her mother, Jenny. Jenny saw her first Panic show in 1994. Now she brings her daughter. "So, Mary," I asked her, "how many Panic shows have you been to?" She said this was her third, said her parents had turned her on to the band. I asked her if other 16-year-olds she went to school with were into Widespread Panic. Mary said, "They don't know who they are." Then she gave me kind of a sideways smile, and I couldn't tell if it was the sheepish look of a kid who is just shy or the look of a teenager who thinks she just might be into something cooler than what her classmates are into. When I asked if she liked the vibe at the show, Mary got enthusiastic. She turned her head around and surveyed the 11,000 people who surrounded her. Then she looked me straight in the eye and said, "Everybody's just happy. It's hard to find a place these days where everyone just wants to be happy." Wow. Out of the mouths of babes, as they say. And I had to agree with Mary. In these times, it is ridiculously hard to find a place where everyone just wants to be happy, and certainly not among tens of thousands of people in one place. This episode of Salvation South Deluxe is about how a rock and roll band from Athens, Georgia, has created a traveling bubble of happiness that somehow protects and unites tens of thousands of people everywhere it is inflated. I'm Chuck Reese, and welcome to Salvation South Deluxe, a monthly addition to the regular short commentaries on our podcast feed. When we go deluxe, we dig deep into a piece of the Southern experience and let you hear some authentic voices that make this region unique and that make a Southern mark on the wider world. Tyler Parrott drove with his two sons from Charlotte, North Carolina, over 200 miles, about 4.5 hours, to see these two shows in Charleston. And the Parrott family will hit the road again in September and drive 400 miles to see Panic twice in Richmond, Virginia. Tyler says he's seen the band over 60 times. So why so many?
You come to shows like all over the, you know, the Southeast, and you see kind of the same people, and it's like, oh, you know, good to see you again, man. How's the family?
David Hannon also drove down from Charlotte. He first saw the band in 1994.
It's a family. There's no better feeling than to be at a show. The people at these shows are just amazing.
That word, family, comes up a lot when you talk to Widespread Panic fans. The shows feel like family reunions to them.
It's a special connection. And, you know, I've played in hundreds of bands, but never in an environment like this.
That's percussionist Domingo Sonny Ortiz, who joined the band late in its first year of existence, 1986. Panic's roots go back to 1980 in a dorm room at the University of Georgia. John Bell, folks call him JB, moved from his hometown in Ohio to enroll at UGA, where he met lead guitar player Michael Mikey Hauser, who grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Virginia native Dave Schools came to UGA in 1983 and joined the pair to play bass. And in 1986, they recruited drummer Todd Nance, a high school friend of Hauser's, to round out the original four-piece band. They named it Widespread Panic for the panic attacks Michael Hauser sometimes suffered. In those early days, the band rented a house in Athens on King Avenue, and they suitably called it the Band House. This is Dave Schools.
Hanging out with these guys and you know, playing music that really just amused us and entertained ourselves. And nothing felt really better than me and Mikey and JB and Todd in the kitchen of the Band House at King Avenue coming up with something that just felt and sounded cool to us.
We slept together, had breakfast, had meals together, you know, cried with each other, laughed with each other.
Over 17 months of interviewing the band members, plus their manager and dozens of longtime fans, I concluded two things. First, in addition to loving the band's music, the hundreds of thousands of people who keep seeing them over and over also feel that other Panic fans have become like family to them. Second, I think that happens because the idea of family radiates from the band itself, from how they've lived and treated each other with care, like a family, over four decades.
It's a big family, so just imagine like a lot of siblings and cousins around the table at the holidays, and you know, there's plenty of differing opinions and ideas of how things should be done. And it translates from the way we run the business to the way the people we contract run their businesses, to the way we play music as the six of us on stage. It goes through everything, but it's family. I mean, that's really the only word to describe it.
I think in preserving our own modus operandi as six band members, which is slightly expanded by, you know, several very close crew members and staff that have been with us for decades, we looked at ourselves as a family, the people that we hired and that go on the road with us. We want to protect them. And we put on these events that seem to bring joy to people.
Every family, whether formed by blood or by choice, must endure trials. And Panic has gone through more than a few. Todd Nance, who had a long history of chronic illnesses, left the band in 2016. Then died in 2020. But the band's first great loss came with the death of Mikey Hauser. From its beginnings in the late 80s and throughout the 1990s, Panic's path went nowhere but up. From 88 to 99, they released six studio albums and toured constantly, averaging 125 shows a year, 1,500 in all. And the home team, as Panic fans refer to themselves, grew like wildfire. In 1998, when the band released Lightfuse Getaway, its first live album, they felt their hometown deserved a free concert. So they built a stage on Washington Street in downtown Athens and invited all comers. This is the woman who was the mayor of Athens in 1998, Gwen O'Looney, introducing the band.
Welcome to Athens, Georgia, the home of Widespread Panic! You have made history. This is the largest CD release party ever! Don't hurt my town!
The crowd she was talking to numbered somewhere between 80 and 100,000 people. As the millennium dawned, panic was filling arenas and amphitheaters everywhere. Then, horrible news shook the very foundation of the band. Early in 2002, Michael Houser was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer.
When Mikey was diagnosed with cancer, I remember to this day, we were riding a bus from Iowa to Milwaukee, and Mikey was complaining about like his lower back bothered him. And I said, man, you need to go check it out, you know? And I gave him, you know, the information of my GP. And I said, just go to this guy, you know, and let's see what's going on, you know, because we're not getting any younger.
Sonny Ortiz recalls that all the band members' families rallied to help Houser's family, his wife, Barbette, their son, Waker, and daughter, Eva.
How can we help the families? You know, everything else will happen as it's meant to be. I believe the rest of the boys in the band believe that there's a stronger entity that's higher and bigger than all of us. And whatever happens, happens. We just have to know that we pour our hearts into the families and we make them stronger that way.
After his diagnosis, Houser stayed on the road with the band until a show in Cedar Rapids, Iowa on July 2nd, 2002. Then he returned to Athens, unable to continue. Panic recruited guitarist George McConnell to fill in. They soldiered on through 13 more shows, ending with a three-night stand in Berkeley, California. They came home to Athens as July ended.
And I remember when I saw Mikey the very last time, you know, he said he was on his bed and he said, "Pat, don't worry about me. I'll be fine. You just got to keep the band going." And I knew deep in my heart that he had discussed it with everybody in the band one-on-one.
Michael Mikey Houser died on August 10th, 2002.
Mikey did not want us to stop because he had pancreatic cancer and knew that it was terminal. You know, I don't know what kind of state of mind, courageousness in the face of impending death or what, but, you know, he was the titular character. It was named after him, the band. So,
right.
You know, we did feel we deserved some time off, but management was scared that if we jumped off the horse, we wouldn't get back up on. And, you know, it is what it is. We kept moving, though.
The family endured. We'll be back after this short break to talk about how it still does. You're listening to Salvation South Deluxe. That the Panic family has not only endured but thrived and grown over the past two decades does not stem only from the vibe that radiates off the stage. The Panic family grows because the band, from its very beginning, has openly encouraged fan involvement. Most bands desire contracts with large record companies that have the infrastructure to produce and market recordings globally, and that will strictly control the sales of all recordings. No bootlegs allowed. Catch someone taping a live show, kick them out of the building, and seize their recordings. Widespread Panic, though, does not follow those practices. Since the very beginning, it has encouraged its fans to tape its concerts and share their recordings with each other. And for the last quarter century, the only record company the band has worked with is its own, Widespread Records.
They allowed tapers from day one. And it was all about sharing. And if the fans themselves caught other fans selling, they'd boycott it. It was all about trading, not selling.
That's Buck Williams, who has been the band's booking agent since it began, and 2 years later became its manager.
We always encouraged that because that encouraged more
people to come to shows and just to spread the music. So we encouraged it by allowing it.
Much to the dismay of record companies at the time.
Record companies hated it.
Oh, yeah. I can
imagine. It's like they thought a bootleg was a lost sale.
That's John Bell, JB, in whose UGA dorm room the first threads of widespread panic were woven. He plays guitar and is the band's lead singer. When we think of a rock band's lead singer, we typically picture a flamboyant person strutting all over the stage. But JB is different. I learned that in our first conversation more than a year ago when I asked him about the remarkably large number of young fans the band was still drawing, even in its fourth decade.
And I'm surprised at how many young kids are still coming out. I don't open my eyes that much on stage, so I've been told that by the people that are watching.
You heard that right. This man, who has performed in front of millions of people since the 1980s, generally stays put behind the microphone when he does, playing guitar and singing with his eyes tightly shut. But then widespread panic doesn't do much at all of what rock bands are supposed to do.
I mean, at first we were taping our own shows and making copies. That's basically what we do to create a demo for a nightclub. That was helpful when we went out of town for the first time, started stretching out, because sometimes music would, some folks would be familiar with it, at least enough to put 20, 25 people in the club instead of just going from scratch. People dug the music, then shared it with their friends or, you know, looked for you the next time you're coming around. It helped build the scene a little quicker in the beginning.
In the 20th century, widespread panic worked with traditional record labels. But in this century, they've stayed independent.
Our first album we did through Landslide Records, an Atlantic-based company. We loved working with record companies, but we kind of got away from the traditional deals and would usually try to sign something like a two-album deal that one was studio and one was live or something like that. So that's when we formed Widespread Records, which is basically just an incorporation to represent ourselves, to kind of have a little more independence.
Record companies have ways of doing things that don't necessarily fit Panic's modus operandi.
They get you, they're like, okay, now here's how you have to do it. It's like, no. We already do something a certain way, you know, and we're too stubborn to change our ways. We thought our approaches were the right thing to do, you know, as far as our own personal warm, fuzzy feeling.
A few hours after JB told me that the warm, fuzzy feeling was important, I talked to a longtime fan in the audience who compared the band to a bathrobe. We were talking about how the band almost never plays the same songs from one night to the next when she said this: "It's like an old bathrobe that you love, but it's like you get the comfort of the old bathrobe with a shiny new finish."
And we don't just go out there and play like we're supporting an album, even though the things might be coinciding. You know, it's, we don't go into salesmanship mode or anything like that. You get kids that they want to come out and be a little surprised. So while there's familiarity in the way we're doing things, the kids really don't know exactly what to expect. You know, the process has been shifted over the years. Like when we first started playing, we would just kind of hint to each other musically, playing a lick that somebody would recognize, and then the band would just steer into the direction of another song without a set list at all. But then as we start getting, we have more and more tunes, it was kind of good for us to get a little overview.
In the green room backstage on the first night in Charleston, I noticed a computer printout. It listed every song from all 13 Panic studio albums, plus somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 songs by other artists. Panic adds about a half dozen cover tunes into every set, and their mix is fiercely eclectic. The list flowed from Ace of Spades by Motorhead to You Wreck Me by Tom Petty, with everything from Van Morrison to Willie Dixon to Tom Waits to Jimi Hendrix in between. Someone had highlighted or checked off several songs played in recent shows, and from what remained, the band would build its set list for the night.
Yeah, our buddy Gary, who passed away some years ago, he began that system with marking off the last three or four shows. So we know what we have done recently and try not to repeat it, something that we played too recently.
Lead guitarist Jimmy Herring, who's now been in the band for almost 20 years, says Panic doesn't have to play the same songs night after night because their fans give them that freedom.
When you have such a beautiful audience that is so, you know, open to anything that the musicians want to try, I mean, that makes the audience actually part of the music. It gives a musician the freedom to get out on a limb and not be afraid to fail. And you know that they've got your back. And it fosters a musician to be able to get out of their own way.
The fan family doesn't demand Panic play the hits night after night. And perhaps one reason for that is that they've never had a hit, at least not by conventional standards. Widespread Panic has never put a single on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, which tracks individual songs. And the highest a Panic album has reached on the album chart is number 27. By standard music business measures, having a band that draws tens of thousands of people everywhere it plays without lots of chart action just does not compute. But everything in Panic World centers on the experience of seeing a show live. The band makes it super easy to have that experience even if you can't be physically at the show. When the band played three sold-out nights at Colorado's legendary Red Rocks Amphitheater in June, it live-streamed every show on the internet. Or let's say you think to yourself, wow, that second show in Charleston just blew me away and I would love to have a recording of it. Well, no problem. Just visit the tour archive on the band's website and you can stream or download shows going all the way back to 1999. You can subscribe and stream anything you want or buy and download files you can keep. Heck, for $26.99, they will even burn you a CD and mail it to you.
You know, every show is for sale the day after we play it.
Every single show?
Every single show. And tomorrow you will buy tonight's show.
You know, philosophically, this band is very different from almost every band out there in the world from the standpoint of being totally apolitical and sharing the music and being, you know, very, very, very generous.
The generosity Williams talks about comes out in many ways. A major one is an operation called Widespread Panic's Tunes for Tots. For the last 20 years, Tunes for Tots has outfitted music education programs in primary, middle, and high schools with more than $3 million worth of musical instruments.
We outfitted the whole Lakota Sioux Indian Reservation in South Dakota for their four high schools with every instrument they wanted. Tubas, pianos, amplifiers, everything. We bought it all. But we've done it all through Georgia, yeah. Tennessee, places that we played where we've raised the money. We try to give back. We go out and find these places that are using soldering irons and, you know, to keep their tubas together.
Yeah.
And see what they want. All we ask is that you take with your phone a little thank you to the people who contributed, 10 seconds or something. That's what the school does, and they send it to us. I mean, it'll bring a tear to you out, because these schools, they have nothing. Right now, we're working on some schools in the mountains of North Carolina that lost everything.
Another part of the Panic organization funnels donations and food by the ton to food banks in cities where Panic plays. That effort began in 1999, sparked by fans, not the band, and oddly enough, by a visit from the Dalai Lama. His Holiness spoke at Emory University's commencement ceremony in Atlanta in 1998, and he handed every graduate their diploma. One of those graduates was Josh Stack.
And the Dalai Lama spoke at my commencement, and his message was sort of one of, if you have the ability to do so, it's kind of your duty to make the world a better place, right? In an ongoing sense. I was working in a corporate law firm, kind of pre-law, and I didn't feel like I was making that difference and really dedicating time and energy to that as much as I could have been.
Stack saw his first panic show in 1994 and kept coming.
I stopped counting at 100, and that was in 2003.
In 1998, Josh reached out to Panic Management with the idea of setting up a table for food donations at their shows. The early response was a no, but Stack was persistent, continuing to pitch the idea as a way to ensure that communities where the band played thought well of the fans who descended on their city for each show.
This is a good way to ensure goodwill around the country. The band would get labeled as ne'er-do-wells who attract a certain element that right. might not be desirable for certain communities. You know, a lot of us didn't really fall under that umbrella. We also wanted to make sure that it was an environment that could support the local communities in some way and leave behind sort of a legacy of giving back rather than just coming and partying in your town for a night and moving on and leaving trash parking lots and whatnot.
When he finally got the band's blessing, Stack started small. He showed up during soundcheck in the afternoon before Panic's 1999 Halloween show in New Orleans with a table and a sign he had hand-scribbled on poster board.
After a couple hours, people want a few donations. Some guy pulls up with a pickup truck loaded down with a few pallets of food. And that's kind of when I knew there's legs to this.
He moved on to other venues, building partnerships with local food banks and issuing press releases before each show. Panic fans would arrive early and drop off financial contributions or food or both.
We would just kind of wait around for the food bank people to come and get food and help load it up, and then they would go on about their business and we'd go into the show.
Over the next 7 years, Panic Fans for Food, as the self-sustaining movement came to be known, wound up collecting $70,000 in 13 tons of food in 28 cities around the country. In early 2008, the band's team took the load off the volunteers and put it on the organization. The band builds partnerships with local food banks around the nation and manages the donations. The operation still continues under the name Feeding People Through Music. Since then, the most recent data shows about $300,000 raised and 43,000 pounds of food collected. Sheila Scroggs of Atlanta first saw the band more than 30 years ago, and she volunteers for food drives when the band comes through town.
Started about 14 years ago helping do food drives at Weister Panic shows. Asking for donations when people are walking into the venue. It's a really easy sell when you're talking to people, when you're like, hey, support the band, support their charity. You know, you get a lot of people, they'll give you a dollar.
A reason Scroggs returns is that the band empowers fans to assist their communities.
I really love the fact that they walk the walk and they talk the talk. Like, they really do care. They are as genuine as they are. They're not the rock stars that you meet that are just really cool for the interview and then they won't acknowledge you if they see you on the street. But I love the fact that they really care about keeping music in schools. A musical instrument can really bring out the light in some kids' eyes.
But the other factor is that over the last 3 decades, the band has helped her build a family of her own choosing.
I've seen them in 2 different countries, all throughout the United States, and I have really cultivated a really great friendship base. why Hispanic is the reason why I met some dear friends.
While I've never seen the same band perform hundreds of times, live music has been a huge part of my own life. I've seen thousands of concerts in venues ranging from tiny nightclubs to baseball stadiums. But nowhere have I encountered a band whose fans feel such genuine affection. Their admiration is rooted in kinship of spirit rather than celebrity allure. For such people, the following Panic isn't just about the music. It's about embracing a way of life that values kindness, community, and freedom. And it is important to note how often the band members themselves express a similar appreciation for their fans. This is JoJo Herman, who has played the keyboards for Panic since 1992.
You know, we've been writing a lot of new tunes. We've been in the studio, and I don't know, it just feels like we're in a great groove right now. And, you know, we've been doing this now for over 30 years, and I mean, you're just thankful to be able to do what I've done for so long. And if somebody comes up to me and says, hey, you know, I like your band or whatever, I'm like, you know, I'm so thankful. You know, I just want to hug them.
In Charleston, I met a woman named Holly Kelly, who had driven with her husband 400 miles from their home in Dothan, Alabama, to see the two shows there. She told me her first date with Zach, her husband, had been at a Panic show in 2011. In 2024, Panic released a new single called We Walk Each Other Home. Holly told me she loves that song because it expresses to her how Panic fans take care of each other. She looked at the stadium full of people and said, it's just such a loving and accepting atmosphere. Thinking about what Holly said reminded me of a passage from Maya Angelou's memoir, All God's Children Need Traveling Shoes, which was published in 1986, the same year as the first widespread Panic show. The late poet wrote, "The ache for home lives in all of us, the safe place where we can go as we are and not be questioned." This band from Georgia, night after night, creates exactly such a place where people can be happy and be themselves without question. It amazes me this still happens even in this modern world, filled as it is with division and anger. And I think there's only one word to describe it, and that word is miracle. We have so many people to thank for their help and cooperation in this episode. Every member of Panic was generous with their time and hospitality and talked to us repeatedly beginning in April of 2024. The same goes for manager Buck Williams and all the crew members we met in Charleston and PR man Dan Beeson. And a special thank you this month to our always mighty producer, Jake Cook, who tracked down Josh Stack and Sheila Scroggs and interviewed them. You've been listening to Salvation South Deluxe, proudly produced in cooperation with Georgia Public Broadcasting and its network of 20 stations around our state. Every week, we add a new 3-minute commentary about Southern stuff to the radio airwaves and our podcast feed. Then, every month or so, we add longer deluxe stories such as the one we've just told you. I'm Chuck Reese, your host and the editor-in-chief of Salvation South, which you can find 24/7 at salvationsouth.com. That's where you can find the full-length feature story I wrote about widespread panic based on all those months of interviews. GPB's director of podcasts is Jeremy Powell, and none of this could have happened without wonderful people like GPB's Sandy Malcolm, Adam Woodleaf, and Bert Wesley Huffman. Please consider giving your financial assistance to Georgia Public Broadcasting and to our entire nation's system of public media. We'll be back next month with another full-length episode of the Salvation South podcast.